I'd like to thank Rocky for this great setup for this talk. Good morning, and I want to acknowledge all of our staff and as well as our providers that have been involved in this project with us. So we have looked at the same issue with rapid syphilis testing, and we looked at reported primary and secondary syphilis over time in Pennsylvania from 2004 to 2015. And looking at our data, we've definitely seen a little bit of an increase over 13, 14, and 15, and now 15, of course, even more. So looking at our cases, predominantly they are male versus the female cases. Okay, in addition, there's been a huge shift in the age. Traditionally in Pennsylvania, we've seen an older age with primary and secondary syphilis. This time, it looks like it's shifting to a younger age, and that's become our worry, because in that age group of that 20 to 35 group, we also have people who also have partners that would be of prenatal age. In other words, they can have children at that age, or of childbearing age, I'm sorry. So in addition, we started looking at that group and how we were going to effectively reach that group outside of the clinical setting. So I'm going to turn this over to Stephen to talk about how we addressed it.
So this map just gives us a little bit of where our morbidity is distributed across the state. Eastern half of the state is the Philadelphia area, Harrisburg area metro. Western part of the state is the Pittsburgh area. So very quickly, every client that gets a rapid syphilis test has to go through a history, very much like Louisiana. If the health, sure. So every client that gets the rapid syphilis test, a risk assessment is critical. We did not want to get into a situation where a person had previous syphilis history and then wasting this test, essentially. If the individual had a previous history, they were just qualified from the rapid syphilis test and got a standard serological draw. I know this is very hard to use, but we use a reverse algorithm in Pennsylvania. We start off with a basic serological draw. A CIA is performed on that. If the CIA is positive, it goes on to an RPR. If the RPR is positive, that test is reported out as a syphilis result. If the RPR is negative, we have a CIA positive, it goes on to a TPPA. And the TPPA is the differentiation if that individual is syphilis or not. The rapid syphilis test added just one additional dimension to that. So everybody who got a rapid syphilis test goes on to get a serological draw. We implemented this test first in our gay campgrounds in May of 2015. Pennsylvania has a number of gay campgrounds in the Pocono region where individuals from multiple states come in and are engaging in high-risk activities. Then we did roll this test out in September of 2015 to our MSM clinics. We have two of those, one in the eastern half of the state and one in the western half of the state. They deal exclusively with MSM health issues. In March and April 2016, we started to roll this out to high-yield chlamydia and gonorrhea testing sites. These are really testing high-risk women for chlamydia and gonorrhea. When I say high-yield, we're talking about positivity for chlamydia in excess of 15%. And then in June of 2016, we started to train our disease intervention specialists to do this test, mainly for high-risk clients initiated for partner services, MSM contacts to known cases, contacts to known early syphilis cases, and suspects and associates. And we're hoping to roll this out to selected STD clinics in 2016. Our goal of this is really to get expedited treatment, first at the patient's medical home, but we do know, as Beth stated, most of our morbidity is at 15 to 30 years of age. Most of them do not have a medical home. So next level of referral is to the testing site if they have the capability of doing that treatment on site. And then we have an existing clinical network of about 100 STD clinics across the state. And in some rare cases, we'll actually refer one of our DIS to go out and issue treatment. So time frame, from May to December, we did 698 RST tests performed. We had a positivity of 4.1%. 52% of those were confirmed positive through a reverse syphilis algorithm. 48% tested negative through RSA, and 4% were lost to follow-up. I do want to state that during this period of May to December, we ran in tandem about 300 tests. Everybody had RST, also had serological tests drawn just to rule out false negatives. During that period of time of the 300 tests, we absolutely had no false negatives, which gave us confidence in the test that we were not going to get false negatives. In January to August, we did 824 tests performed. Positives identified were 2.5%. As Louisiana stated, as clinicians, practitioners got used to using this test, they got better at interpreting a positive. 48% were confirmed positive, 43% were tested negative through the RSA, and 9% were lost to follow-up. Some lessons learned. Implementation of RST is not as simple as the manufacturer indicated. In Pennsylvania, all RST tests must go through a CLIA waive process. We also have a Bureau of Laboratories internal process that we have to go through as well. So there are lots of policies and protocols that we had to write up. The STD program is slightly concerned with the high potential rate of false positives in the RST. The test is costly. No ifs, ands, or buts about it. Total test to cost to identify one positive using RST is approximately $17.25 versus $7.25 using the RSA alone. Currently, no dual rapid test is available for both syphilis and HIV. The PASTD program is eagerly awaiting for that test because we can split the cost with our HIV counterparts, and it's only one finger stick. Concerns of regarding underreporting of syphilis cases as the RST platform is expanded out to the private sector. We're really fearful that as providers get a hold of this test, they're not going to be reporting those cases to our PA-NED system, and they're going to be counting that as a positive. And with the data that we were showing is that not all positive RSTs are actually positive syphilis cases. We're also working on our Bureau of Laboratories to revoke CLIA waive profiles for any providers failing to comply with reporting requirements. We also need to modify our online reporting system to actually capture those RST positive test results. Even with modifications of online reporting system, the STD program may have to rely on laboratory reporting of RSA results. So in a nutshell, this test is a good tool. It does have a very high false positive rate, but like any other tool, if it's used properly, I think it has an appropriate place in our tool chest of prevention efforts. The thing that was most concerning to us as it rolled out was the false negatives. As we did over 300 dual testing platforms between the RSA and our reverse algorithm, and we did not find any false positives whatsoever. Or false negative, excuse me. So, but the false positives are definitely an issue.
Thank you. Don't go away. So, I'm going to take moderator prerogative and ask the first question, and that is actually maybe two questions. The first is, now that you have demonstrated that you don't have a false negative concern, are you still immediately doing a blood draw or only doing a blood draw on those people that are positive? And I'll ask you the second one just so you can do them both at once. The second one relates to the cost of the test, which I'm not at all arguing is not an expensive test. But when you compare the cost of the rapid test to the cost of doing the RSA, usually you do the RSA in a more clinical setting. Are you taking into account all the physical infrastructure that is, you know, involved with that, or are you just looking at reagent and test costs?
All right, so the two questions are, we are not doing follow-up blood draws on all RSAs. When we roll the test out to a new platform, such as those high-yield chlamydia screening sites, we are going to be doing dual testing of all RSAs just to get baseline. So every time we introduce a new platform, we're asking that provider to go ahead and do dual testing on everybody just to roll out that false negative. The second question is that we're only looking at the price of the testing. Okay. That's it. None of the infrastructure associated with
it. And next question?
Yeah. I was wondering if you – I'm Ashley Carter from Virginia, and this is probably for either Rocky or Steve. I'm wondering if once you began to get data rolling in, did you have any pushback from the clinicians at the local health departments or whomever was seeing the patient? As to limited clinical utility? And secondly, I haven't really seen positive predictive value used as a metric, and I'm just kind of curious why it hasn't been used. I think that sensitivity and specificity are high, but and even false positivity, but we're seeing a positive predictive value of about 38%.
So to answer that question, in regards to the clinics, we have not had any pushback. When we first rolled it out, The provider that was actually doing the testing in the gay campgrounds is also an STD clinic. So he felt that was a very good niche to identify the positives and then refer them in for more comprehensive services for the treatment. In regards to the predictive positive value, that's actually a good thing we need to look at.
Hi, Christina Schumacher from Johns Hopkins. I had a question about your cost estimates, and one of the huge advantage of doing the point of care test is the ability to treat right then and there and to initiate partner services immediately instead of waiting 3 days, a week, 2 weeks, whatever, for the results to come back and then to go and find the patient again. So in terms of, and if you just looked at the reduction in the time to get people treated, that extra $10 per test becomes way worth it. And so I wonder if you were planning on looking at that and incorporating that into your cost estimate.
So in regards to our DIS rollout, that's one of the things we're going to be looking at is that cost reduction, because it's a 24-hour to 48-hour turnaround for the standard serological draw. In the gay campgrounds, based on risk, based on behavior, based on the client's history, there was some treatment right there on the spot at the gay campgrounds with a positive RST. But it was very selective based on those high-risk behaviors that were occurring there. And I said a lot of those we may have given them preventive treatment to.
One of the things I think that we need to focus on, too, is that if you have that high yield in low positivity, they're not positive, but you're bringing them in, you've now got an opportunity to talk to them. So in other words, it's a false positive, but that's a positive thing with a high risk group of people. So you're going to bring them into clinic, and then you're going to be able to say, you know what, you were really negative for syphilis based upon our blood draw. However, we can offer you PrEP, we can offer you further HIV testing, and we can talk about your risks and your behaviors. So I think that that's the positive piece of this. If you look at those false negatives, that there is a positive shine on it, that's that half glass full kind of thing. So I think that's a positive thing from this. Although that faint line is also a big issue as well.
Hi, this is Jenny Bowen again. I had a question about your comparison group. So you've got syphilis rapid testing over here compared to some kind of, in air quotes, gold reference standard up here. It looks like you guys were using the algorithm as your comparator up here at the top. So I'm a little concerned about the use of the word false positive, since this is just a treponemal test, and you're comparing it to active infection, somebody who's TPPA and RPR positive, hypothetically, or CIA RPR positive. Did you do a comparison where you just looked at how the test performed next to the CIA, just by itself, okay, the CIA?
Well, I should clarify that everybody that had a false positive we identified had a CIA RPR and then the confirmatory TPPA.
Right.
Right, but I think what she's asking is, if you look just at the rapid test compared just to the CIA, those are two treponemal tests head-to-head, and did you do that?
We did not.
I might consider it, only because it's tough to start saying that this syphilis health check product is producing 50% false positivity. It kind of is it's shaming the product when the product was not actually trying to detect active infections. I mean, it's not a screen and confirm. It's just kind of a treponemal test. So I would just say, so that we don't end up throwing the product baby out with bathwater, you might want to just.
And that analysis is really easy to do because it's all ELR data, so we can quickly pull that out.
Hi, Stephanie Taylor, and I am the medical director for the Louisiana Health Department for the STD program. And so one thing, as I continue to hear more and more about these false positives, is I really think that we should either talk with the Syphilis Health Check, Trinity. There needs to be a minimum that somebody needs to pass before we should just say, do this one time, and you go out into the community and start doing the test, which is basically, I mean, we don't say, okay, you have to do 10 before, have them correct, before now you can go out into your CBO and begin to do them, because primarily, it is a technique issue with the false positives.
So to address that, every place that we roll out has to get trained by the manufacturer, and they actually have to do some testing right there during the training. So we're trying to eliminate part of
right.
that.
Right. Everybody does testing right there in the training, but I'm saying there should be a minimum amount. There's not, and I think that would help somebody to do it over and over in the presence of the training and then say, okay, yes, you're ready.
And I think this is one of the predominant issues that we have to take into account for all point of care tests is how are we going to do quality management? I mean, you know, we know that there can be protocol drift. We know that with HIV, we learned that we got a lot of trouble because clinicians or VCT volunteers, you know, weren't paying attention to timers. It's very little things. And then even if they do everything correctly, interpreting that line can be difficult. So I do think it's important to keep that on our radar screen. But thanks, Stephen. It was a very nice presentation.